You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Does picking an outfit have you running a little too fashionably late? We get it. Great taste takes time. That's why Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery, has your back with the largest selection of beer, wine, and spirits delivered in under 60 minutes. Convenience never goes out of style. So if you need to spend some extra time in the mirror instead of at the store, download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com today.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name's Barney Hoskins. To my left is Mr. Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
Possessor of the greatest laugh in music podcastery.
Is that right?
It's official.
Is it official?
It is.
This is fantastic news.
It probably means you're not going to laugh at all in this episode.
That's it.
Mark and I are sat here with the wonderful Michael Watt. Welcome.
I've always found Mark's laugh rather irritating.
Now you'd be irritated by my laugh as well.
No, I don't mind you. You're better modulated.
That's hysterical. We've got off to a great start.
Yes, but that's splendid.
Mark now won't laugh at all. I'll have to do the laugh.
Yes.
Michael, it's wonderful to have you here. Michael is a living legend of, well, journalism, not just music journalism. Yeah. But
in barely living legend.
We'll sort of see how barely living by the end of the episode. But, Michael, we've been trying to get you on this podcast for a long time, and I think we finally had to threaten physical violence and offer a bottle of wine to get you here. But here you are. And we're really honoured to have you.
The money has helped.
You mean the bus fare?
No, Uber,
let's try and be serious.
Mark, you're laughing.
Sorry.
For anyone who's listening who doesn't know, Michael was one of the most important music journalists on Melody Maker and then had an illustrious career on Fleet Street after that. You were an editor, a deputy editor, a features editor. You've had a terrific career in journalism. Maybe the most famous thing about Michael, you'll hate me for saying this, but Michael is the interviewer to whom David Bowie, falsely as it turned out, claimed that he was gay and always had been in 1972. And we may talk a little bit about Bowie and some of the other artists that you've interviewed over the years. Mm-hmm. You came to London from the Midlands and you wrote the first pieces of your career, I believe, for the Walsall Observer. tell us about where you got started as a journalist and as a music writer.
Well, I worked on a local newspaper in the West Midlands, as you say, the Walsall Observer. And it was at a time when the Midlands heaved with exciting new groups like The Move, Spencer Davis, The In-Betweens, who became Slade, Robert Plant and his Band of Joy, and the Moody Blues. I mean, strange as it may seem now, the Moody Blues playing at the Stork Club in Walsall with Denny Lane wailing away on harp and screaming, "You've got dimples in your jaw, in your drawers, sorry." Well, one of the best R&B bands of my tender youth, until, of course, I saw the Lippman Rao folk blues tours of the late 60s and early 70s. And then I became aware of Howling Wolf, John Lee Hooker, Skip James, who was my particular favourite. You saw them in the flesh. It was quite odd, really, that these teenagers, white teenagers, were obsessed with the tragic stories of these ancient men who were shortly to die. But it was an extraordinary phenomenon of that particular
period. Are you saying they put the Moody Blues in the shade?
I'm afraid so, yes. I'm afraid so. But of course, every self-respecting white boy in that period was steeped in the history of the Delta Blues. And, and also, I guess, the appropriation of that music by white musicians, notably Bob Dylan, but of course many others in this country, guitarists like Clapton and Peter Green and so forth. Later on in my life, I did meet Dylan on the set of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Yeah.
This was in Durango in Mexico. It was not yet a time of Mexican drug cartels, but it was still
you were
quite
for the
hairy.
Cartels. You couldn't find them.
I did see an actual gunfight between an extra and a local, in which I can't remember which one it was, but they got winged in the arm and whisked away. It was quite tough blows.
You witnessed that? Did Dylan and Sam Peckinpah witness that?
Well, Peckinpah probably did, because Peckinpah was an alcoholic and pretty much...
And like guns.
Out and like guns, pretty much off his head. But I was there. I'd flown down from New York because I was at that point Melody Maker's American editor. Sounds very grand, doesn't it? It was quite grand, because I was living in Upper East Side, New York, and my neighbour in the next block was Frank Sinatra.
Seriously?
But I, of course, my arse was hanging out my trousers, and the doorman, he had a problem as I walked past him, letting me in to the building. Anyway, I was chasing after Dylan, and we were shuttling backwards and forwards on a plane from the film set to Mexico City, where Dylan was recording the soundtrack and knocking on heaven's door. And on one occasion, I flew back, having got nowhere in Mexico City with him. And he gave me this, well, I didn't know it was him at first, but I felt this terrific nudge in my ribs sitting on the plane. And I turn around and I stared into these cold blue eyes of Bob. No smiles at all. And he wouldn't be interviewed, and it was very difficult to actually say, will you be interviewed? But I got a very clear impression he didn't want to be. But he was very keen to talk about the MM. When Dylan first came to London,
yes,
when he was appearing in the play, I think Madhouse on Castle Street, was it?
Yes, so that would have been, what, 62?
Because he's always been that very inquiring spirit. He came into the MM trying to find Max Jones, who was a big-time jazz writer.
Yeah.
Max wasn't there, so they threw him out of the office.
That's fantastic.
They thought he was what was then known in the vernacular of the times, a lumber or a pest. So he never got...
Dylan
was thrown out of the office.
We actually have...
He remembered all that.
Yeah, well, we have a Max... Because Max, via his son Nick, is one of our writers.
And we
do have a Dylan interview that Max did after that, obviously.
Yes.
There was something... Of course, none of this quite matches the Beast, Richard Green's... he got up to Dylan's hotel during the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970 and got so drunk that he couldn't remember a word Dylan said.
But, Michael, I mean, how did you come to write on Melody Maker in the first place? Give us a little background on that, because I know that you started there around the same time as several other great writers, some of whom we've had on the podcast, Richard Williams notably, that you came from provincial newspapers. You'd actually cut your teeth on local journalism. You actually knew how to do this stuff.
Well, I don't know what Richard said about it, but so many of us, if not most of us, on the MM at that period in the first half of the 1970s had worked on local newspapers.
Charles Wood was the same, wasn't he?
We were professional journalists as compared to the kindergartens and wunderkinds of the MM.
Dilettantes like me who came along later.
Who had no basic newspaper training at all, but I covered everything from golden weddings on my local paper to crime stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, often in Walsall in the West Midlands, involving gypsies. There was nothing the good people of Walsall liked more than to burn down a Didicoy's caravan.
Right.
So you had to do those kind of things and be prepared to write about what one might think of as minutiae. But I also had this column, I think it was called Mick Watts on Entertainment.
So you were Mick then. I remember sending you an email. I think it was, hi, quote unquote Mick, and I think you came back with less of the Mick. But I guess in that era of Mick Jagger, every Michael automatically became a Mick.
Well, at a certain point in life, I gave up. I sold the name Mick. I sold to Mick it Jagger. To Mick Brown, actually.
Who also has been here.
Yes, who I've always thought ever since was something of an imposter.
There's only one Mick in this game.
But I gave it up because I wanted to be...
taken more seriously. More,
yeah, I wanted to be more formal.
Did that coincide with you arriving at Melody Maker? That was just...
No, I was Mick on Melody Maker for a good time.
Were you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I always went by the byline, Michael, because the back of
I see what you mean. The byline was with Michael.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But on my local paper, it was...
Mick Watts on Entertainment.
It was Mick. I'm sorry to say.
And how long did that column last? And
it was about a couple of years.
About?
And, you know, I was in the position, lucky as I now realise, because not too many other people I've ever met have that kind of power on a local newspaper. But I was quite bolshy and pushy about
it. Hard to imagine, really.
It is. But I interviewed every musician who passed through. So, for example, when Ginger Baker's Air Force played at Birmingham Town Hall, I interviewed George Harrison and Eric Clapton. I sat between them and they were kind of like grumpy old men. It was like being with Waldorf and Statler from the Muppets. They didn't have a good word to say about anything. But then also, of course, there were the local bands, and there was a kind of profusion of them. People like Black Sabbath, whom I interviewed at the local Methodist Hall.
Fantastic.
And Edgar Broughton Band.
Oh, yeah.
Who, of course, are managed by their mother, who was also their roadie.
I didn't know that. That's fantastic. Yes.
Their mother, who was also their roadie.
I saw them, God knows how many times, at free concerts in the park around 69, 70, doing the whole Out Demons Out routine.
Out Demons Out, yes, of course. Out Demons Out! As we would say in the Midlands, Boston.
What happened to your accent, Mr. Watts?
It's a good point. My mother claims that I never had an accent, but she was possibly...
You were born with BBC English.
Possibly a little bit biased. Yeah. Received pronunciation has always come easily to me.
Yeah.
But it was such a great... appeared in the late 60s, probably everywhere, but particularly in the Midlands, because there were so many of these bands.
Yeah.
And Mothers, for example, in the Midlands, which was an old furniture place. Edgbaston or Erdington, I think.
Erdlington.
Yeah, Erdlington is where it was. You know, everybody in the so-called British Underground played there.
Yeah, yeah.
I think bits of Floyd's Amagama were recorded there. Mm-hmm. And then after they played at Mothers, they went to... one of my all-time favourite clubs, the Elbow Room in Aston, near Villa's football ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where Steve Winwood, who was, of course, the most famous local boy, I think that's where he formed Traffic, actually.
Yeah.
I was also friendly with a group, probably largely forgotten now, called the Red Caps. And they had a minor hit with Shout, which, of course, was covered the following year by...
Lulu.
By Lulu, right. With much greater success.
Originally an Isley Brothers song.
Originally the Isley Brothers song. You know you make me wanna shout. Say my hands up and up. Say my hands up and up. Say my hands up and up. Come on now. Don't forget to say you. But the Red Caps were essentially two brothers. They were called Walker. They actually were the real Walker brothers. And they were tough lads off the estates. And I hung out with them. And Mick Walker, with whom I was particularly friendly, he introduced me to lots of local musicians. I can always remember Roy Wood coming up the footpath to the front door of Council House where I lived with my parents, and my father looking through the window, half standing, and saying, "Bloody hell, who the hell is he?"
Well, you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, because, you know, there were lots of freaky people who came to my house. I also met, through Mickey Walker, Jasper Carrot, who I knew as Bob Davis. And his career echoed Billy Connolly's, really. They were musicians, folk singers, whose funny patter became their whole career.
Yeah.
Mickey Walker, who was quite a hard man, he eventually became a bodyguard to Elton John and to Freddie Mercury, who probably needed it. Dave Walker, his brother, who was the singer, Mickey was the bass player, he became one of the many lead singers of Fleetwood Mac. You don't remember that, do you?
No.
There have been so many.
Yeah, well, it was that period when they were marching through people every sort of 10 minutes, weren't they?
Yeah.
The Bob Welch's of this world and so on.
So, eventually...
Sorry.
Mick Watts on Entertainment became so famous...
In the Walsall area.
And beyond, and because beyond next Walsall. Thing I know is I've got the call from the editor of the Melody Maker.
I see.
A man called Ray Coleman, who was a kind of slim, trim man with balding, with oversized glasses. And he looked like the showbiz editor of a national tabloid. He was very kind of beguilingly old-fashioned and sort of reassuring, really, because, you know, there weren't people exactly like him on the Walsall Observer, but you knew the type. It wasn't like being confronted by Nick Logan, for example.
Right.
Anyway, he hired me.
Yeah. In 1970?
No, he was 70. Yes, I think Richard Williams joined Melody Maker in 1969 because, you know, he's a much older man than I am.
Saucer of milk for table 12.
Yes.
Although he looks younger than all of us put together.
That is a depressing fact.
Well, he discovered the eternal secret, didn't he? But he was very, very fortunate secret. That I was hired by the MM because I was on the verge of getting fired from the Walsall Observer. One night I went back in a rather drunken, gleeful mood and trashed the office and forgot everything about it until I went in the following morning and was met with all these people with grave faces, my colleagues, shaking their heads. And then I noticed that a metal trash can had gone through the window. So I think, you know...
So rock and roll, I know. Mick.
It wasn't, Mick. Wasn't exactly a Hollywood TV set, but
it wasn't Keith
Lone enough to get
chipping
you
a TV set out the window. Well, but it's close as Walsall
we'll
got
about,
to
we'll
that.
Talk about
we'll talk
Keith
about Keith.
So yeah, most of the staff had been on local papers. When I arrived, within an hour of being there, I was sent to interview Diana Ross.
Fantastic. Within an hour.
Within an hour. I had no preparation
That's
at all.
Amazing.
And I remember, I think it was in a room at EMI, a sort of dimly lit room. And Diana Ross literally breathed glamour. And I can't remember anything she said, because she probably never said anything interesting at all. But I do remember her hands. She had these amazing hands with these, you know, the way black women look after their nails.
Yes.
And all I can remember is these sort of hands waving around with what looked like sugared almonds on their tips.
Yes.
And I thought this was tremendously impressive.
Yeah.
So I left that interview thinking, hey, I've arrived.
Yeah. You
know, I'm in the big time. Denny Lane, he's the part.
Right.
So it, and then it kind of went on from there. Yeah. I mean, most of the MM interviews, certainly in the beginning when I was there, we either interviewed in the Golden Egg in Fleet Street, place which no longer exists.
Thank God.
Or we went to the Red Lion pub, which is up an alleyway. We met loads of people there. I took Del Shannon there once. He was, I liked a great deal. He was terrific. And he'd walked into the office with the so-called mayor of Sunset Strip, Rodney Bingenheimer. And then later, when I was the MM editor in Los Angeles, and living in a very decrepit, rather sinister Chateau Marmont.
You lived at the Marmont.
I went nipped down the road to Rodney Bingenheimer's E Club, E standing for English, of course, because he was a tremendous Anglophile. And I recall that I went there once, and either Michael Oakes or somebody acting for Michael Oakes took this great picture of Led Zeppelin,
yes,
with all these young ladies, yeah, which included baby groupies, we call them, which included Sable Starr and Laurie Mattox. Yeah.
Or Laurie
and,
Lightning.
Then, this caused great consternation.
With the
Robert
Zeppelin
Plant's
wives.
Marriage, yeah,
yes,
in particular. In fact, he rang up the MM in an explosion of fury at running the speed.
Well, this great quote. I mean, when I did an oral history of Led Zeppelin, it's a great quote. Apparently, Robert calls his wife Maureen at home in, you know, near Kidderminster and goes, "You can't believe everything you read in Melody Maker." Not that Robert speaks like that, but
he does rather than.
He hasn't lost it. He has still got. He's got a posh Midlands accent.
It's
posh
not
black
bad.
Country.
It's okay.
But he's a lord of the black country.
He is. Yes. You know, and the thing I like about him, he's stayed pretty true to his roots, actually.
Yeah.
I think he still has a place. Does he still have a place in Kidderminster?
Yeah, he still has his place there, and he's still got his place in Wales.
How long? Because you were in America for quite a long time for Melody Maker, weren't you? Both in Los Angeles and New York. How long were you there
in
total? About?
Probably about 5 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a great period in my life because the record industry was so affluent.
Yeah.
And the bands had terrific license to do whatever they wanted, to behave as they wanted. So it was hedonistic and freaky. I remember going on tour once with Frank Zappa, one of the more interesting and erudite men I've ever met. But we played at Smith College, which was a very posh girls' school in Massachusetts. Mm. I think, I quote, "for girls of high ability and promise." However, they turned out to be like the girls of St. Trinian. And they threw this terrific party for us in the ladies' lavatory at Smith College. And, I mean, I have this distinct snapshot in my head. Everybody sitting on the bogs, looking across this marble floor, everybody else sitting on the bogs, and these girls milling around, and you're wondering where the hell this was going to go. You know, it really was great fun. And, of course, in Frank's retinue, he had a lot of interesting people, like the GTOs, who are unashamedly groupies. But he also had, and I met her, Cynthia Plastercaster, one of the Plastercasters, whose vacation was to model the penises of superstars like Jimi Hendrix and put them in a museum somewhere. I'd like to see that museum now.
I'm not sure there's ever been an official museum.
No, Cynthia still has her.
They're in a bank vault in Geneva.
Let me tell you, I still have her business card as well.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah. It's never far from my person.
But also, you were very, very quick on the uptake with bands like the New York Dolls. I mean, some of the earliest writings about the Dolls is
Well, if you lived in New York, you couldn't escape the New York Dolls because they were the flavour of the moment. And all the rock hacks in New York seized on them very quickly. You know, I'm not sure in retrospect whether musically they were that great, but they were great for two albums. And they'd, you know, things like Jet Boy I still occasionally play.
But
I did see them play at a place, unfortunately, no longer there, which was the Rainbow Room at
Bieber.
At Bieber, which is a most amazing venue. And that actually was a great, great night. They did play really well. But
I have an ashtray my father stole from the Rainbow Room in my flat.
Still got it?
Yes, I've got it.
Bring it in. Yeah. Do you, I mean, because so many people always talk about the NME in those days, and do you, and I mean, maybe some of the other writers that you were on the staff with, I mean, is there ever a slight resentment towards that when you guys were such great writers and arguably there were better writers on the Melody Maker? It just didn't have that Nick Logan kind of hip young gunslinger element to it.
The traditions were so different.
Yeah.
You know, the MM was a very old, historically old paper. It had begun in 1929. It was founded upon jazz and jazz bands.
Yeah.
It also had this, it was the mouthpiece of the music industry. And of course, when the NME came along, that worked totally against it. You know, because the NME, punk, Sex Pistols, all of it was about a kind of rebellion and overthrowing everything that we stood for. I mean, unfortunately, at some point, the MM became also a mouthpiece for prog rock. Still popular with Jeremy Clarkson, but actually none of the rest of us liked it apart from Chris Welch.
Yes.
But it sold tons of records.
Yeah, yeah.
And Ray Coleman, the editor, he followed the album charts religiously.
Right.
And so whoever was in the top five of the album charts, he was very... And it was a logical thing to do, write about.
As a consumer, I mean, I was a Melody Maker reader from 69 through to about 73. 73, I was relocated from London compulsorily for a couple of terms, shall we say.
Were you rusticated?
I had an altercation with the Metropolitan Police involving hashish and was packed off to boarding school by my parents. But when I came back in 73, everyone I knew had moved over to the NME.
Yeah.
It was literally 72, 73. Mm. There was this sort of, wherever I went, people...
I can't say your experience, but I think the NME really happened round about 75. You know, I remember once going to Copenhagen to interview Poco, a band in whom I had little interest, really. But I was on the plane next to Nick Logan. You know, Logan was then a kind of down-table sub at the NME. I could never have predicted. Yeah. Nick would
reinvent
so
the
well. No, yeah. Reinvent, yeah. He didn't really reinvent it. His predecessor, Alan Smith, was largely responsible.
Whose stuff, you know, we have on Rock's Back Pages, and I remember having lunch with him and him sort of saying things to that effect.
I think it's very important that Alan Smith
gets credit.
But, you know, the NME writers, we had amazing respect for them. And this rivalry between us was great.
It was healthy, wasn't it?
You know, I mean, I thought Ian MacDonald, whose book on the Beatles is peerless.
Yes.
Charlie Murray was a terrific writer. They had others as well who I really respected.
I think Brian Case is one of the great writers about jazz, for example, and he was at that time on the NME. He moved to the Melody Maker later. Thing is, what
I've got
like
a bit tired of
is that my job here is that I'm now reading Melody Makers at a time when I'd stopped reading them at the time.
So you're discovering.
And I'm discovering how good Melody Maker was. You know, so you in particular, Richard Williams in particular, Chris Charlesworth, I think, was a very good writer.
Well, Chris Charlesworth was a great news editor, actually. He was. Again, somebody had worked on
Local Rag,
Yorkshire, whatever it was. Yeah.
So it's a real pleasure for me rediscovering all this stuff, and that I do think that the history of British pop journalism has been somewhat skewed by this idea that the NME became the winners of some sort of battle of the 70s.
Yeah. They are much more astute at
it's better design.
Manipulating and creating their own publicity.
I think it did look better. It looked less stuffy,
The
NME,
I looked the other day for the first time in decades at one of the old MMs. I mean, the typeface is 2-point unreadable. And it was a challenge even to read it, but the layouts were very poor. However, with the exception of the front pages, the front pages were classic tabloid.
Yes.
And they were amazingly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever we put on the front page, whatever it was, who's touring or whose album out, it sold records.
Yeah.
It sold records and it sold tours. You could go to New York, you'd see it on the newsstands.
Sure.
And it was amazingly attractive to be a member of MMC. So you're out there in New York on the stands.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other myths that the NME was the first paper to really write about punk, and this simply isn't true. Caroline Coon was writing, and in Sounds, John Ingham, were writing about punk, well, but really before anyone on the NME
brings me to mention a piece. Sorry, I had to bring it up. A piece that you wrote, which you haven't got on RBP as yet, but you wrote a piece in September 76 called So Shock Me, Punk.
And did I?
You did. Yeah, no, it's...
I can't remember.
Okay, and it was a little bit reactionary, but you did then go on to write about the first of the three pieces that we're featuring on the homepage is your account of being on tour in America with the Pistols. But you did write this piece, So Shock Me, Punks, and at that point you were a little bit negative towards punk rock as it was sort of emerging at that point.
Well, I think there's a very good rationale for that.
Mm.
First of all, I was older. Popular music is forever teenage, as John Savage might say.
Mm.
You know, it's always reflecting the tastes of the current generation, which is always rebelling against the previous one. So that makes nostalgists of the rest of us. You know, we are proof sitting here talking about stuff that happened 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And the NME, because it had a less stuffy background and it hired all these people like Charlie Murray from
the
British
press.
Underground press, they had no constraints, really, not the constraints that were placed upon us.
Sure.
Trying to cover who was heading the album charts.
But as
we had a built-in disadvantage.
Yeah. No, but equally, as I said, that Caroline Coon was writing about punk very, very early and shortly after.
It was to Ray Corman's credit that he hired her.
Right.
You know, the rest of the staff didn't care for her presence. And I think he'd also said something which probably is not much remarked upon on Rock Buck pages. I think looking back, we were pretty sexist. You know, it was very male-orientated. And Caroline Coon, bless her, had a kind of difficult job trying to come in and assert herself and write about music, which, frankly, most of the people
absolutely hated.
She went from sort of literally writing about kind of Gilbert O'Sullivan to writing about The Clash and going out with Paul Simonon in the space
managing
of a year.
The Clash.
And managing The Clash, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it seems because your
she didn't have a problem because she was dyslexic.
Yeah.
The subs hated her because they couldn't. They had to make her copy.
When I met your friend Val Wilmer, last year, that's one of the things she said about The Melody Maker, is she felt very conscious as a woman that it was a distinctly kind of misogynist, sexist attitude towards women amongst the staff there.
Yes.
And it's certainly, you know, it's something which still sort of is
I
very
hope
pleasant.
She accepted me, because
I gave
her lots of gigs to do. So she was probably nicer towards me. But I think looking back now, I can, when you look at it in the context of what's going on today and hashtag Me Too, or that there was never any sexual harassment that I know about. Yes, it does seem that way.
Sure.
But the good thing was that it gradually, through people like Caroline Coon and Vivian Goldman, the presence of women became, it made itself felt more.
And a lot of women photographers started emerging.
A lot of women photographers, You know, Penny Smith.
Absolutely.
And
Sheila Rock.
Jill
Famanowski, so it did change, but I think we'd have to hold our hands up. We were a kind of boys' club, you know. We drank hard, and it was exclusive of women, I think, in that period.
Michael, we'll talk about one other piece before moving on to everything else that's new on RBP, which is an interview you did with Bowie in Berlin in early 78. He's on the set of Just a Gigolo, the film being directed by David Hemming. Terrible film.
Terrible film. Do you know one of the funny things about that film? You may know this, but that film starred Bowie with Kim Novak and Marlene Dietrich. I met Kim Novak. I didn't meet Marlene Dietrich.
No, that's
the reason being
the
that
piece.
She was in Paris. And Bowie and Marlene Dietrich never ever met, although they had these scenes together.
How extraordinary.
And Marlene Dietrich died not too long after after this. But it was a dreadful film. But to me, it was interesting. In Bowie terms, it was interesting because he'd changed so much by 1978.
Well, that's very much what the piece is about, because you had interviewed him. I don't know how many times.
He was considerably more heterosexual by 1978.
Yeah, but I was particularly interested to revisit this piece because you had done that famous interview. He actually says, he said in an interview with Roy Hollingworth, another Melody Maker writer we haven't mentioned.
Yeah, we must remember Roy.
Yeah.
A year after that interview you did, he said, it was Melody Maker that made me. It was that piece by Mick Watt.
Yes.
And I became a performer after that. So he really kind of credited that particular piece with changing something in his attitude towards performance.
Well, I interviewed him a lot of times, and not just for the MM. I went down to Beckenham just as the Ziggy thing was breaking. I don't know whether you've got that piece in your files, but we spoke for a long, long time. He was living in whatever the name of that famous place was.
Something Hall.
Beckenham.
Hadworth Hall or something.
I don't know. Hall, I can't remember. Yeah. But anyway, I remember going there. It was a rather nice place. And the first people I met were Angie Bowie and their son, the then Zowie.
Yeah.
And he'd not seen his father in his Ziggy Stardust makeup with orange hair. Bowie eventually peered from downstairs, walked into the room, and the kid took one look at Bowie and sort of howled with fright. And then a minion, had to come along and take the child away while we had this conversation.
How extraordinary.
We couldn't sit down and talk about it. That period really was... I toured across Texas roughly in that period, maybe a little later, with Bruce Springsteen, who I thought had equivalent charisma, although he was a completely different person. I mean, I think I can legitimately say that I saw the future of rock and roll before John Landau.
But didn't say it.
I think with Bowie, I think he was the future of rock and roll. I don't think that tag ever got applied to him. But when I met him, and in the pre-Ziggy period, the hunky-dory period, I also interviewed Tony DeFries. He's rather sinister manager, but a brilliant huckster. Mm-hmm. And DeFries was the son of a Shepherd's Bush market trader who'd become a lawyer in the music industry. Mm-hmm. And he told me that Bowie and Angie came into his offices at Main Man. What a naff name that is.
Yeah. Yep.
And he said they were holding hands, and he said... I always remember, he said, they were like two lost children, Michael. And he had such big plans for them. Mm. And Bowie wanted, although he'd had the big hit with Space Oddity, he was really falling. His career was ailing. And he wanted DeFries to get him out of a lot of deals and set up a new ones.
Yeah.
Which DeFries duly did. But DeFries was a very uncomfortable person eventually for Bowie to be around. And I think much of the freak show that revolved around Bowie, a lot of that was engineered by DeFries, mm-hmm. who had interesting tastes, I think. But Bowie told me in Beckenham that particular time, right from the start, he wanted to be much more than a pop star. And I think pretty soon he felt constrained by his bisexual image, and also by the fact that DeFries wanted to make him a commodity. Mm-hmm. I mean, DeFries actually told me, he said, I see David as a skyscraper on Sixth Avenue. He had all these plans. Not long after that, I remember there was a picture, I think also taken in Beckenham, of Bowie as Ziggy and Angie with her cropped hair looking very butch. Mm. And the headline in The Sun was, "Which is Mummy?" And Bowie, I think, really wanted to escape from that.
Yeah, yeah.
It really was irksome.
His move to Berlin, which was basically a year and a half. Well, first of all, he went to America, did Young Americans.
And then he got totally wasted and then went to Berlin.
And then the move to Berlin, producing that extraordinary trilogy of albums.
Yeah.
And, you know, people talk about almost too much about Bowie's reinvention, but actually for him they were necessary steps to maintain his sanity.
I think his gift and his curse was that he could inhabit any style or idea and yet at the same time remain true to himself. Mm. It felt kind of real, not forced. Of course, what his crusty critics said... Mm-hmm. Maybe people like Richard Williams, I don't know. they said he's not authentic, I suppose, meaning in the tradition of 12-bar blues, rock and roll, and so on and so forth. But, you know, is a white guy playing 12-bar blues on a guitar anymore authentic?
Well, exactly.
This is what I mean by Bowie creating a kind of template for what came after, where you could play with all sorts of musical forms and not... be tied down by those restrictions.
We touched on this when David Toop was here about this notion of authenticity being inherently fraudulent.
Yes.
Which
it is.
Which it is, particularly in something like pop music.
Yes.
It's the bane of our lives now that there's a whole generation, particularly in America, of people really demanding some sort of notion of authenticity, which strikes me as entirely fake. Mm,
mm. You know, the concept of samples.
Yes. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, ripping off other people's records, we might have called it back in 1973.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to have to move on.
Yeah.
Or this is going to end up, this will be a two-hour podcast, which would be great for us, not so great for our producer. So what we would say is please stick around, Michael, and just jump in with anything that occurs to you. But we do need to just briefly talk about what else is new on RBP. And so I'll just skirt through. The featured artist is the great Swamp Dog, Jerry Williams. We have three pieces about Swamp Dog, who is a fascinating, very short rhythm and blues singer who kind of reinvented himself as a rather subversive kind of rock and soul slash funk singer-songwriter in 1970 with this extraordinary album, Total Destruction to Your Mind. He had been a singer, he'd had like very minor hits, and he had been hired at Atlantic. He says in an interview with Andrew Purcell from 2000, he was hired because Atlantic felt they had to hire some black producers.
Right.
So he sort of came in on that ticket, wasn't given an awful lot to do, did then produce some amazing records by people like Doris Duke and even Solomon Burke. Mm-hmm. And then basically woke up one morning and decided he was going to call himself Swamp Dog, and he was just going to write about whatever the hell he wanted to. He wanted to break out of kind of soul music, per se. So there's just this great piece from Rolling Stone in 1970 by the late John Morthland, which catches Jerry at this very moment where he just talks about the decision to he said somewhere, and I don't know if it was in this piece, he said, commencing in 1970, I sang about sex, niggers, love, rednecks, war, peace, dead flies, home wreckers, Sly Stone, my daughter's politics, revolution, and blood transfusions. Okay, so it's not an everyday story of R&B producers, but I mean he has a new album out this week, which is a kind of country album, and he's always straddled the sort of country soul divide. Just fascinating little guy, so funny, such a funny man.
We had this thing a few weeks back in the podcast. This quote: he never really sold any records. I mean, as an artist, he never really sold any records, but he had a lot of very good songwriting credits and production credits. And so he'd go into these offices, these record companies, and they'd be basically sneering at him. He said, then I'd go out and I'd get into my Cadillac and drive back to my fabulous ranch because he didn't need to sell records. Yeah. He was making a great deal of money from all these other sources.
I don't know about a great deal of money, but enough. And he's always somehow, he's just one of those great kind of hustlers with a fabulous sense of humour.
I love that cover of that album where he's standing on the table.
That's what we've got on Rock's Back Pages this week.
Oh, it's fantastic.
That picture of him tap dancing for these sort of white corporate executives. So we tell the story of that album cover and identify the people in it.
That's right.
He's just delightful. Yeah. I mean, I've never met him. I did get a letter from him once. I would love to. He made an album a couple of years ago called Life Loss or Love Loss and Autotune. I mean, it says everything about the guy.
They're
well worth reading.
Worth reading.
Yeah, definitely worth reading. I mean, Michael, if you've never heard Swamp Dog, I think you would find him immensely amusing. Start with Total Destruction to Your Mind and then move on to Gaga Maggot. Tell us, I mean, in a sort of site, I mean, not exactly a kind of New York theme, but they established themselves in New York at CBGB's along with all the punk bands. The Cramps.
Yeah, this is our audio interview for this week. It's Martin Aston interviewing March 86, which is about their 10th anniversary of their existence, somewhere around that.
Yeah, it is.
It starts off with them talking about, it's about the album A Date with Elvis and their obsession with all things Elvis. They talk about what A Date with Elvis would really be like, which would apparently be him reading to you. About how Rick Nelson was actually weirder than Elvis because Rick Nelson was subversive by being a middle-class Los Angelino doing this sort of rock and roll music. They deal with the accusations of being a pastiche band and the difference in rockabilly and rock and roll, and they sneer at rockabilly as a term. Then they talk about Gravest Hits and Alex Chilton as the producer. And we'll listen to this clip where they're kind of interestingly withering about Alex Chilton.
Really?
He was constantly saying that we should be like the Clash and write songs about politics and stuff. I mean, like, he thought so little of us that he was constantly saying this crappy shit. 50 shit you're doing, you know, we've got to be making new wave music. That's what's popular now. That's what they're buying and stuff. I mean, like, I get so sick of people talking about him like a great cult hero. I mean, like, it's fine, you know, like, I don't want to shoot down. If somebody enjoys having him for a cult hero, that's fine and everything, but it's too bad.
Just don't know why.
I mean, that's pretty interesting because everyone reveres Alex Chilton so much.
Alex Chilton was the box tops, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
The
star.
Letter.
Yes.
Which is one of the all-time
fantastic
records. Rock singles, I think.
I think both Barney and I have a lot of time for Alex Chilton, but there has been created this sort of cult of Alex Chilton from Big Star and so on and so forth onwards. So it's quite refreshing to hear Lux Interior sort of, you know, put a different gloss on it.
I was really kind of thrown by that because it just sounds very unlike Alex Chilton, you know, to say we should be making kind of new wave records. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he did genuinely fall in love with the Cramps and their whole kind of 50s sort of voodoo shtick. So the idea that songs The Lord Tortoise, recorded at Sam Phillips' International studio in Memphis, was going to be anything like The Clash just seems so improbable. But we have to take the former Eric Perkheiser's words for it. I love the fact that Poison Ivy, who's also, of course, interviewed in Sitting by His Side, was born Christy Marlena Wallace. It's just perfect.
And I love the fact that they got together when he picked her up hitchhiking.
Absolutely.
That's how the Cramp started.
Yeah.
You know, producers immemorially have tried to overimpose themselves on artists. You know, you just got to think about Phil Spector and Leonard Cohen. You know, the two great, ill-matched talents.
Well, Lux also says that he was drunk half the time, and the other half of the time, he didn't even show up to the studio.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Chilton was those days.
That man would never have worked for the Melody Maker.
Really? I mean, he'd been given a staff job, wouldn't he?
Yes.
On the NME.
They also talk about, they'd moved to Los Angeles by this time, and they talk actually quite extensively about what it's like for them and their type living in a city like Los Angeles.
At home with the interiors.
We'll get onto that in a second. First of all, their hatred of tans. You know, this is the wrong city to hate tans. And how they can obviously have to maintain their pallid skin by staying indoors all the time. they talk about the 80s as being a really dismal time for rock and roll.
Which it was.
Well, yeah, in some respects. In some other respects, it was terrific. Depends on where you're coming from. At the end of the podcast, we'll listen to a fairly marvellous description of, life at home with Lux and Ivy and the interior of their house, which is rather fabulous, which it includes, they started collecting drawings by serial killers. And they got a rock from Ed Gein's house and things like that.
And a portrait of Lux on the wall
by
John Wayne Gacy.
That's right.
You know, it's slightly macabre. Like, I mean, I have some problems with this stuff because, you know, I know it's all meant to be very, like, ironic B-movie Herschel Gordon Lewis stuff. But actually, there's a slight insensitivity there that troubles me.
Yeah.
The way they talk about their kind of collections. And did you ever see the Cramps, like the Cramps?
I saw the Cramps. I liked them. Tried to book them when I had a TV show.
Did you?
And they never...
They never showed up.
Fucking turned up.
Oh, it was great.
I mean, I really did enjoy listening to them. I'd never heard Lux and Ivy kind of speak. What struck me, given how we think of the Cramps, is just how serious they are about all this kind of kitsch culture that they're immersed in. He reminds me, listening to Lux more than anything, he sounds a bit like Neil Young, the way he talks. And it's very peculiar. But, you know, given that the Cramps were, you know, celebrating kind of kitsch and trash culture, what you realise about them is there's a strange paradox, is that it's actually a very serious kind of art form for them. You know, I saw them a number of times. I always enjoyed them.
I
always kind of assumed that they, you know, hanging out with the Cramps would be kind of a laugh. And there's nothing very funny. They're very, very earnest about these crazy, kitschy, trashy things.
I mean, in a sense, when they talk earlier in an interview about how they resist being regarded as a pastiche act, that's in a sense why they are so serious. Because if they aren't serious, then it's very easy for people to tag them as rock and roll revivalists and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. In a way, the Cramps are more like an art project than a band.
That's my feeling.
You know, I saw them three times live, hugely enjoyed them, never felt as looking at something reactionary. You know, something about the way they disported themselves on stage. I mean, I'd seen countless sort of English pub rock and roll revival bands and all that sort of stuff, and it's just revolting, you know.
Yeah.
And they were a quite different beast.
Yes.
Even though sonically they were out of the Sun Studios and so on and so forth, it was just a whole lot more interesting than that.
Is this a brilliant collision of very sort of feral rockabilly and sort of B-movie, very low-budget horror movies? I don't think anyone else quite did. They inspired a lot of bands,
but also they're only one step away from sort of like almost no wave bands, of out there music. Actually, sonically, they will often go right out onto
no bass guitar until, in fact, A Date with Elvis,
right,
or when this album comes out.
But American culture breeds bands like that, artists like that, you know, because they don't have the kind of classical heritage that we have. Everything is commercialized. You know, their movies, their music, their radio programs.
Yeah.
So they pick up on it and they're more familiar with those sort of forms, I think.
I think it's, I mean, if you're a Cramps fan, it's fascinating to listen to these. I mean, Lux died 2009, I think. So he's long gone. But I always had a soft spot for them, saw 3 or 4 or 5 amazing shows. It was just a one-off in kind of rock and roll culture, I think. It's a really interesting interview to listen to. What else have you got for subscribers
week? Well, the first piece is just a news report, but it's to really welcome a new writer, Ivor Davis, who was the Daily Express's West Coast correspondent.
Do you remember
that
name?
I do, indeed, yeah.
Yeah. Now, he didn't write much about pop, but he wrote about everything. So, you know, politics, blah, blah, blah. And this is a report on the death of Sam Cooke, 12th of December 1964.
Oh.
And it's a very straightforward news report. You know, the strap is hotel manageress fires 3 shots after girl in chase drama. But Ivor went on to really cover the Manson stuff very, very closely. He's written a book.
He has written. He's sort of self-published a book. Yeah, he's still alive. Yeah. Is he still in California?
I don't know.
Right.
So we've got masses of his stuff, but not much that we could use. But when he wrote about pop, it was as a news reporter.
When he was a stalwart of the Daily Express.
That's right.
He really was.
He really was. So we're very glad to get him on board, because aside from having like critical writing and so on, I actually like just news reporting about music from the time. Second thing is August 67... Melody Maker had this thing where called Blind Date, where an artist, an artist would kind of do a sort of blind reviews of the week's singles. And this is Beach Boy Bruce Johnston. And they put obviously put a tape recorder in front of them and just record it verbatim. Jimi Hendrix, The Burning of the Midnight Lamp, track records. Sounds like a demonstration record for the Wow Wow foot pedal or pickup. It almost sounds like Vanilla Fudge. Is it the backside? It's getting very good. I think the intro was too long. Oh dear, they stopped to take a rest again. Is Donald Duck the conductor? I'm not putting it down. It's good. It's very groovy, and now it's happening again. Good guitar solo. Get it on, baby. Now this Wow Wow section makes sense after you've sung Loneliness is Such a Drag. These kind of records seem to reflect what the people on the scene think and which way everything is moving. Good.
So
that was Bruce
of the squarest people I've ever met, Bruce Johnston. So it doesn't, I mean, it's really funny to hear.
The MM's Blind Date was Nick from Downbeat.
Was it?
Yeah.
Right.
It was that basic idea. And Blind Date ran for quite a few years because it was a really good format. But generally speaking, most of the people, obviously well known, were terrible.
Oh, yes.
They just didn't. It just showed you they didn't have any critical appreciation.
Was it the Four Tops we had from Blind Date the other day, which was absolutely hilarious?
That was really good.
Absolutely right. Paul McCartney's was quite good.
Yes.
That was good. I read that one.
Yeah.
You
know, he's sharp.
Very, very sharp. Very cute. Yeah. Usually getting the artist right straight away. You know, that was very revealing. This is a guy who really listens
had
to
really
stuff.
Had really good ears.
Yeah, absolutely.
Still does, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Sound 72, Martin Heyman interviewing Lou Reed. Now, this is interesting because...
Martin Heyman?
Yes.
He's been on RBP for a while.
This is when Lou Reed was just finishing the recording of his first solo album in England.
Produced by Bowie?
No.
This is the previous
That
one.
Was the previous one. I forget.
It was produced by Richard Robinson.
Richard Robinson.
That's right.
Yeah. Mr. Lisa Robinson.
Yes. Pretty well.
In
Smart
New York.
Guy.
Right.
Anyway, this is literally talking about Andy Warhol. He said, Andy had this incredible ability to be at the centre of everybody, which ultimately caused us a lot of problems. And then he also goes on, everyone assumes that Lou lived the life that he describes in his songs. And he says, lots of the characters I wrote about, I wouldn't want to be alone in the same room, but I thought vicariously it might be fun for other people to meet them through music.
Hmm.
Which is kind of interesting, because there is an assumption that Lou lived the life, and actually it's not entirely true, or at least not to the extent that everyone sort of imagines.
I mean, you must have sort of experienced the kind of fag end of that in literally in New York.
Do you really mean that, Chris?
I mean, this sort of the Maxis period,
yeah.
the by now slightly aging Warhol superstars of the 60s.
I used to go down Maxis about every other night,
yeah.
And they'd all be there in the back room. You were never quite allowed to approach
Warhol's
great and the good.
Table. Mm. But I saw some great acts there. I actually saw Springsteen play there with Bob Marley as his support. It was one
Blimey.
Of the best... double bills I've ever seen.
Did you write a review of that for the Melody Maker?
I may have done. I
think we may have that on the site.
Yeah.
So this is great. Actually, it's Talking Heads' first ever London show at the Rock Garden in Covent Garden. A certain Rich Williams, dare we mention his name?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Writing for The Times, Richard says, two rock bands from New York, both conveniently accepted as constituents of the current new wave, are actually proposing a fresh and promising direction for the music. One is Television, a lean quartet which arrives in Britain later this month. The other is Talking Heads, whose London debut occurred before the local punk Cognoscenti in a congested Covent Garden cellar on Friday night. That was quite a famous show. I mean, I actually tried to get in. I couldn't.
Yeah.
It was absolutely rammed,
Yeah.
And he goes on later in the thing, he gets it. He talks about Psycho Killer as being this riveting song.
I'd love to have seen that show, I have to say.
They were such a surprising band for all of us Talking Heads. They were like nothing else.
Yeah.
Sort of.
I mean, in some ways, my favourite album is that first album, even though I think they went on to do, you could say, more interesting things. I still think I remain massively fond
were
of
they...
that record.
They was sort of happened at the same time as punk, but they weren't really.
Well,
they weren't really part of it.
I don't think any of the New York bands outside maybe
the Ramones, the Dead Boys,
and people like that.
But Television weren't
a punk band in the literal sense.
What 15-minute
Johnny Jewel?
Nothing at all to do with.
Absolutely.
Primitive life forms like the Sex Pistols.
Well, quite. Which is why I don't tag them as punk when we post those articles on the site. You just can't.
I agree with you. Psycho Killer.
Moving on to 1988. Tiffany. Popstrel Tiffany.
Oh, now we're talking.
Max Bell. This is the number one magazine.
Max Bell
became sort of Tiffany's... He interviewed her kind of regularly for the magazine. Yes, it's quite extraordinary. This is a man who would rather talk about the Grateful Dead than anything else.
Latched
onto Tiffany. And she says, I've done a tour of shopping malls where I sign autographs and do a mini show of tape backing. Those places where kids of my age hang out, so it's a natural move. I don't think anyone's done it since the 1960s. So this was the new phenomenon of the mall singers, Debbie Gibson. Being another one.
Yeah.
The Wire, 1992, David Toop, the wonderful David Toop, is interviewing George Moroder, and this is about I Feel Love. He, Neil Bogart of Casper Records, he liked the song so much that he wanted to have a long version of it. And that's when I did the 17-minute one. The official story is that he was playing it at a party. People wanted to hear it over and over. I think the real one is more like the bad story. He was doing some other thing than dancing. I should have developed this German accent, really, to kind of get the full effect. Marky Smith of The Fall, the interview by Lisa Verrico, Vox, 1994. I hate hippie children and their fucking crusty rubbish. Why? Because they're the only generation to have turned out exactly like their parents. And later on, the country's turned into a bunch of whinging, mithering bastards, yeah, going on about nothing at all. Spoilt brats. I mean,
love the word mithering.
Mithering.
Is there a reason you didn't do that in a Mancunian accent?
Because I can't do a Mancunian accent.
Just checking.
And the last thing is just because I think this absolutely encapsulates the nauseating sort of self-regard of the Britpop mid-late 90s. All these preposterous acts who really thought they were absolutely marvellous. And this is the audience, all lowercase, all one word. The audience is Sophie Ellis-Bextor. It's Robin Bresnahan, Melody Maker, 98. I'm still as good a pop star as any. I answer back, have opinions. I love the sound of my own voice. I fulfil the criteria. I mean, that's just sick-making.
Well, I like Sophie. She lives around the corner from me.
No! Oh!
Right, OK. We have a problem here, wait, Houston. No.
I see her in the local garden centre every now and then.
You Chiswickians, yeah. Yes.
Chiswickian. Yes. I mean, I couldn't stand her as an artist, you know, and there's something so smug and self-regarding. And this interview is just riddled with smug self-regard, you know. And, yeah, you know, so that, anyway, I've
that's
shot,
your
my,
lot,
my particular bolt has been now shot.
I'm very keen on flamenco. And I'm very keen on the flamenco rock artist, Rosalia. Do you know?
Oh, no. Yeah, she's huge. She's huge. One of the biggest stars on the planet.
You go to Spain and she's so big.
Yeah. But that was apropos of what, Mr. Watts? It was just a random
Spain
statement.
Many years ago. No, I was just thinking about new things.
Right, new things.
New things that were good, yeah, as opposed to Sophie Ellis-Bextor.
Bextor.
You know, and I went to Spain some years ago and I saw flamenco. I was absolutely bored. I think it was Spanish Delta Blues, really.
Just make sure that Ms. Ellis-Bextor doesn't listen to this episode of the podcast. Otherwise, she may cut you dead in the garden centre.
We'll have a conversation over the chrysanthemums. There's these couple of bastards just down the road.
Yeah, that's us. We're out of time, folks. It remains for us to thank you so much for coming in. You haven't had to come that far, but we're still eternally in your debt for
coming in from
Chiswick.
It's been a joy. And he's kept the laughter to a minimum, I think.
not in this ear, he hasn't.
I've got
tinnitus in this ear badly enough as it is. After 65 episodes of the RVP podcast,
you'll be having.
I literally can't hear out.
You'll be at the Moorfields sort of.
That's the eye hospital.
Who's next week? Don't tell me Sophie Ellis-Bextor.
Do you know what? The sadness is next week there will be no podcast.
What?
I know. We're taking a break and then we're back the following week.
Is that because our Jasper is mithering off
Jasper
on holiday?
Jasper probably has our mithering podcast off on holiday. Has other things to do, better things to do.
The coronavirus.
Yeah, this is, we are.
We didn't talk about that.
If anyone's listening to this in 100 years, we're in the midst of the coronavirus outbreak.
The great plague of
We may be dead by the time the next episode is due to be recorded. Look, we've had a lot of fun. I mean, if this is the last ever music podcast, I'm glad it was you, Michael.
It went. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
I generally end things.
you have a track record of littered with debris of various enterprises.
See me and die.
Yeah, exactly. We will see you in a couple of weeks. I believe Pete Perfides is coming in as the guest.
Yeah.
But I couldn't swear to that because my hold on the near future is shaky at the best of times.
Absolutely.
It might be Paul Gambaccini. It's either Paul Gambaccini or Pete Perfides, not both. We will hopefully
the
be sat here having survived the virus. So it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me, possibly for good.
And it's goodbye from our special guest.
Farewell.
Excellent.
Bye.
Our house is like a museum.
We have a beautiful home.
We really have a beautiful home. We have a bamboo bar with blinking lights.
A tropical bar.
And a go-go girl that when you push her button, she moves around and shakes, and she holds a drink in front of her and shakes the drink to mix your drink.
A really great bar. And we have a great big TV. We have a 45-inch.
We have a big TV
big
set.
Screen TV. So we watch movies a lot.
And we have presents that we've given each other over the years that are real nice. We never throw anything away.
Of our adventures.
It sounds very, very warm, though. I mean, not warm sun, but it's sort of very.
Oh, it is. It's a love.
It's a true love story.
That was Lux Interior and Poison Ivy of the Cramps in conversation with Martin Aston in 1986, concluding this week's Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Michael Watts. Find more of his writing on his Rock's Back Pages writer's page. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and the producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.